Reset the podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand. Whether it's low alcohol or no alcohol, Liars helps you enjoy your classic favourite cocktails.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the podcast. A place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Today I talk to a woman who has been at the very heart of the creative industry for over 25 years. As Editor-in-Chief of Campaign, Claire Beale is probably better served than most to talk about the many changes that the industry has seen over the years. And we do explore this during our chat. But behind this experience lies a woman who is gutsy, brave, and determined. We explore all three of these traits in our time together and her journey towards changing the rules on civil partnership, which gave her a purpose way beyond work. Finally, we discuss perhaps her greatest professional challenge following an interview with Nigel Farage and how, through the strength of her relationships, she was able to come through this, learn some valuable life lessons, and the determination to start a business of her very own. Claire, it's so good to see you this morning. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling really good. It's Monday morning, so I'm bouncing, but it's very grey and drizzly outside, so if only there was sunshine, my life would be really very good this morning.
I know, I think it's the same for all of us, isn't it? Well, we're going to talk about a lot of things today, but we're going to start with the fact that you were at Campaign, ultimately as editor and then editor-in-chief for the best part of 25 years. So a long time by anyone's standards, but you know, absolutely at the epicenter of the marketing and communications industry, I think. Why did you stay so long?
I absolutely loved my job. I think I never woke up in the morning and thought, I don't want to do today. I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't want to have to do this thing. There might have been one or two kind of hideous days, but over the course of more than a quarter of a century that I was working for the same company, I felt utterly privileged to do the job I was doing. I loved it.
Well, you know, during that time, of course, you saw so many resets. The title of this podcast is all about the kind of resets that we go through in our work and our life. And I guess there's loads of them. But perhaps one of the ones at the beginning would have been the big break between media and advertising agencies. What was that like? How was your view on the industry changing at that moment?
It's funny, actually, though. I started off on Campaign covering media. So actually, when that happened, suddenly the bit that I covered became much more interesting. But what it meant for the industry as a whole is there were more companies for us to write about, more new business models emerging, more entrepreneurs shaking things up. So that just created a new wave of dynamism in the industry and just gave me more people to talk to. My network increased, the number of interesting entrepreneurial business people I met increased. So it was a really good spark that just kind of created a fresh momentum for me quite early on in my career. And yeah. I, you know, some of those people that I met then were quite fundamental to me really enjoying the industry and loving being in it and feeling comfortable in it.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. That point about the kind of entrepreneurs that were then around. You know, Johnny Hornby set up CHI, and then which is now the AMP Partnership, at a very similar time to when I set up Haystack Group. And, you know, so he's been hugely successful, but it's quite interesting that you can grow at those sort of similar times. Are there any entrepreneurs that have been particularly striking for you or has had a big impact on your career and or you really admire?
Yeah, I think one of the people I've always really respected and just thought was an amazing human being is Helen Cowcroft. So when I first joined the industry, she was quite senior at Abbott Mead Vickers, but there's just this sort of beautiful person, just kind and supportive. And then she became a brilliantly successful entrepreneur and doing two startups through the course of my career. And she's just been such a touchstone of how to do good business with elegance and a good spirit in this industry. And obviously one of the few early female entrepreneurs to start to shake the market up. So she's phenomenal. And I'm so grateful that she's been this kind of touchstone through my career.
Yeah, she's a sort of a beacon of all sorts of things, actually. Hope, brilliance, understanding for many of us. I think she's an amazing woman. But I think you're right, that point about creating a business, but also doing kind of good and doing it in a good way. Because I think, again, look, we've seen a massive change in industry, haven't we, for across all sectors in the last number of years. But the communications and advertising industry in particular was very male dominated, still is in some ways, quite boisy, a bit aggressive, a little bit sexist. And I guess for all of us, we've come to recognise some of those challenges in our industry. Was there a moment when you looked up and went, do you know what? This isn't great. There's something we need to do about this.
I don't know if there was a moment. It was a kind of gradual realization, which, you know, I feel guilty I didn't come to earlier, because I'm fully aware that I've worked on one of the leading platforms in the industry for a long time, and that is a powerful platform. And, you know, it wasn't, I worked there for several years when I was just, you know, a small fry and didn't really have any influence. But I think collectively we didn't question things enough. And I remember us doing more than 20 years ago now, but doing some organogram of the fantasy agency, taking all the leading lights of the London market and putting them into this fantasy agency. And I think there might have been one or possibly two women out of a whole organogram of business titles on there. And I nobody thought about it or questioned it. And obviously, apart from women, there was no other conversation about diversity either. So there wasn't a moment, but I think I'm very grateful to organisations that started pushing us and kind of nudging us. And I think over the last 10 years, 15 years, we did slowly become a force for good in the industry, but I do wish it had happened earlier.
Yeah, I know, it's funny, isn't it? I think you're right. I don't know why we didn't question it. But I certainly think we are much more aware now, and hopefully some of the work that we've done, and, you know, you've been amazingly supportive of some of the stuff that we try to do at Oyster Catchers around, particularly around diversity, more recently with Let's Reset on well-being in the industry, just highlighting some of the inequality and just some of the stats. Because I think one of the problems is if we don't measure it, we don't treasure it, and it hasn't made enough of a difference. I guess then another reset that happened was the whole piece around technology. So digital enablement, just the change, I guess, for you in a media group where you went from paper to online as well. But that was sort of happening simultaneously with the internet and the whole digital revolution. How was that like? How did that feel like?
Well, I had two, I'd say, core impacts on my job. Obviously, it changed the industry phenomenally, but working as a journalist, I went from working on a weekly print magazine that happened to have a couple of award shows attached to it, where we worked hard maybe 3 days a week as our print deadlines approached. And then the rest of the time we were much more, sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. Yeah, we went from working hard for a couple of days a week to 3 days a week when the print deadlines approached. But then the rest of the time we were, the magazine had come out and we'd have a couple of days of lunching. And we went from that to an always on, not quite 24/7, but deadlines were happening all the time. And the online beast was really hungry animal that always needs to be fed. And obviously that, the way technology changed, it changed not just the fact that the magazine went online, but that we were able to take it internationally more effectively. We branched out and did much more video and audio, and the whole business model mushroomed from being fairly one-dimensional to being a really multi-headed business that had lots of different revenue streams. And obviously the irony is the staff numbers shrank dramatically in that time. From yes. When it was a print magazine, it was
yes
very well staffed. But as more and more jobs became tasks, came yes. online because of digital, the staff base shrank and shrank and shrank. So,
yes, which is the challenge, and we've seen that across all sorts of industries, yeah. haven't we? And you know, and that does have a challenge with it as well, doesn't it? You know, one of the things I guess I wonder about, because you have this sort of power as the editor, because you're right at the epicenter of the industry. And one of the things I used to say to the Oystercatchers team was, you know, because Oystercatchers were helping clients find agencies, and agencies would understandably be very keen to get the business and also quite grateful when they won, and maybe a bit upset when they didn't. There was a similar sense of power, and because people are genuinely nice in the industry, but they're also kind of taught to be nice. I would always say, look, just work out your friends by, if they come to your funeral, they're a proper friend. If they're not, it doesn't matter, but it's just, they're just doing their job. Yeah. How did you cope with just that adulation, real and perhaps sometimes perceived? Did it ever go to your head?
I don't know if there's ever any real adulation. I certainly never kind of felt like, I never felt like that. I was always very aware that I had a bit of power and influence, and that was useful. And it definitely gave me a massive amount of confidence, because I didn't go into this industry as a confident, outgoing person. And I wouldn't say that actually as a person I am confident and outgoing now, but I have, there's something about being able to walk into a room and know that people want to talk to you because you're influential, or because they need to know you, not necessarily because they think you're the most amazing human being and you know, a scintillating company. But walking into a room and knowing people want to talk to you just really changes the way you move through your social life. And so working on campaign definitely gave me that level of confidence. And if that is ego, then ego. But it never was about feeling I'm amazing. It was just about I can move through the world with the power of a really respected brand behind me. And that eases the social situations in which I find myself. So, to be honest, I think it's quite useful, probably to have. It's been quite useful for me to have a bit of an image where you have this stature. You know, that's useful because it opens doors. But all my friends say, oh, people think you're really this or that. And actually, you're not at all. You're so warm and nice, and which I am, of course. But I think the way when you have a profile in a small industry, people kind of use the shorthand and don't really know you, of course, in the way that your friends know you. So I never took it that seriously. I just used it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Do you think that part of that's being female or not? I always think that if I look at the way that men are described, they're often described in slightly sort of more positive terms than women in the industry still.
I've always felt really it was a power being a woman in our industry. And I know that comes from the privilege of working on a working for a platform that has some power. I think if I was working at an agency, as I realized this, the reality of being a young woman working at an agency over the years I've been in the business was very, very different. And thankfully, I never experienced that. I always felt it was a power being female, but you know, being a woman with a little bit of power in a male-dominated world wasn't a bad place to be. I'm much happier now being a woman in an industry that has many, many more senior, powerful women, because I just think that diversity just gives us a richness and a colour to the industry and a fairness, obviously, and an equity to the industry that it never had when I started out. But I think there are lots of experiences of being a woman in the industry that I didn't have because I've always had one foot in, but also one foot out.
Yes, I can agree. And I think I could totally agree. I think it's lovely not having to be the only female in the room, which we were for a long, long time. And it's brilliant that we have much more diversity at senior level of women and men running agencies. I guess the other part about the feedback and the way that you become online is you do get feedback. You get feedback from agencies, from people, from your readers, from your listeners. I'm always fascinated to know what it's like from your perspective when the campaign score report comes out. And the campaign score report is one of those moments where everyone in the industry gets very twitchy. It's a big deal. There is more of an understanding that it might be a fair number, it might not, but it is a big deal. What does it feel like from your perspective?
It's a massive responsibility, but actually that is one of the things that has changed since I started out, as technology has changed, is that you're no longer, whatever type of journalism you do, you're no longer kind of broadcasting out. You're part of an interactive ecosystem. So whenever anything like the school reports comes out now, there's a lots of ways that people feedback how they feel about it. In the old days, it used to be lots of phone calls just from the CEO, who's either pleased or very annoyed. These days, everyone is able to voice their opinion on this stuff. And that's healthy. It just means that you can't have as many kind of meaningful conversations with as many people as you want to, because there's so many viewpoints coming at you and you just can't respond to all of them. Yeah. But yes, it's an enormous responsibility to sit in judgment on people. And we always took that responsibility incredibly seriously. It is hard. It became harder, and it's, I'm sure, harder now for the people on campaign, because when for the longest time we knew the agency world inside out, upside down, you'd know the agencies you were writing about like nobody else would know them, or possibly you would have known them, Suki, but you know.
Not many people.
You know them.
Yeah.
So you look beyond what they say, you look beyond the numbers, you know what the culture is, you get under the skin. As staff numbers have reduced, the number of agencies has increased, actually having that depth of knowledge became harder and harder and harder. So to sit in judgment becomes harder and harder and harder. And we held it together So I think the last school reports that I oversaw, I was really confident that we managed to give a good and honest representation of agencies. There's always some cut and thrust and some mistakes you make, and people obviously feel very emotional about things, and there's always that. But I think we were always really quite so well informed that they were really accurate. I think that gets harder and will get harder. So with my new business, one of the things we don't do is sit in judgment on people and companies. Because the responsibility means you need to really, really know your stuff.
Yes, and you've got to have the time and the people to do it. We'll come on and talk a bit more about that, but I agree. And I think certainly in the past, where we were at Oyster Catchers, I mean, you know, 98% of the time we would be exactly in the same place with your number on the school report. So it was really interesting from our perspective, because it was a good sense check for the Oyster Catcher team. But sometimes, you know, you don't always get it right. And I'm thinking about perhaps that moment, which perhaps was a reset, I don't know, where you put Nigel Farage on the front page of Campaign and an interview with him, and had a pretty significant outpouring from the industry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was a really traumatic, dramatic and important moment, actually. It was one of those situations that came about through a vacuum of leadership, in that we'd had a UK editor for Campaign and they'd been made redundant. So there wasn't a UK editor, and various people came in and kind of dipped their finger in the magazine, without really knowing the industry in the way that you need to really understand your audience inside out. And I was a global editor in chief, and obviously I had kind of oversight, but and I took responsibility for it because I had seen it before it went out. But it was a really important moment. It was a moment where we managed to offend so many people, and the vehemence was really shocking and salutary, and it was a reminder of that position of responsibility that you have, and it was a reminder of the need to stay close to your audience and to understand, make sure that you understand how they feel. And it was a reminder that you do need really strong leadership. And it was a moment when the industry made full use of all of the channels that are now available to talk back and to make clear how it felt. And it was really, really traumatic. And we apologised, which of course we were only too, like, you know, the desperate need to apologise. There's another great thing about technology is you can apologise quickly and vociferously and get your messaging out there. So we were able to move really quickly to say, you know, we screwed up big time. And we spent a lot of time listening to people, talking to people, getting out there and getting their feedback and taking advice. And it was a really important moment because it was a moment that just said you're not invincible, you're not omnipotent. You screw up, like, wow, you couldn't screw up much more than that in terms of the offence that was caused. It was really dramatic. So it was a moment of reset in a really positive way. It took us back to the fundamentals of thinking and listening and leading and responding and reflecting the industry and reflecting on it. And it was like a lot of crises turn out to be, it really good positive things came out of it. But it was can't underplay the hurt and the kind of trauma of it.
Yeah, very, very tough at the time. But as you say, that the relationships that you've established, one of the things I think there's a real benefit to either being in an industry for a long time, in a job, on a role, is that you do have those long-term relationships with people where you can reach out to them, you can have a conversation, and that they can give you some understanding and give you another chance.
Yeah, I think that's what really saw us through, is that we were a team of really established, we were a very established team and we had very established reputations. So people knew we're not bad people. We screwed up, but once they'd vented their anger and frustration and kind of bitterness and all the emotions that it churned up, so many people were just like, can we help you make sure this never happens again? Yeah. So it was thanks to those long relationships and the reputations that we all had in the industry that we were able to get the brand through it. And if we'd been a new team without that level of connection with the industry, I'm not sure where the brand would be now, but it was testament to the strength of relationships that my colleagues had with their contacts and the reputations that we'd all built up in the market, that we were able to learn from it and get through it.
I can see that. You've done lots of things outside the industry as well, and I think the one I wanted to particularly talk about was the campaign that you and your civil partner Martin Lote went through to get a civil partnership for a heterosexual couple to be legal. Why did you do that?
Well, we've been together for a very long time and we never wanted to get married. We never wanted to be husband and wife. It didn't really have any emotional relevance to us, and I'm very respectful of the institution of marriage. To the extent that I didn't want to denigrate it by doing it, even though I didn't emotionally buy into it. So it's perfect for some people. It just wasn't for me. And I didn't want to get married just for the sake of having a legal kind of bond with Martin. So we started to explore what other options were out there for legal recognition of our relationship. It was important because Martin didn't have any the same legal rights over our son Emerson as he would have done if we were married. So he couldn't apply for a passport for Emerson, he couldn't sanction medical intervention if it was necessary without me being there. There were all sorts of legal issues around not being a recognised unit. If one of you dies, you have to pay inheritance tax, so you almost inevitably have to sell the family home. So there were lots and lots of issues, and we looked at other legal options out there. And if you're same-sex couples, you had two options. You could choose to get married or you could choose to have a civil partnership. But if you're opposite-sex couples, you only had the one option. So we fought to be able to have those two options for ourselves. The Isle of Man introduced opposite sex civil partnerships before mainland. So we went as part of the campaign and as part of the awareness raising, we went and had a civil partnership over there, which actually did become recognised over on the mainland when the law finally changed, so we didn't have to do it again. And we got the law changed. There was another couple that actually pushed it all through the high courts, but we were part of a small campaigning team. We worked for three or five years on it. It was a proper campaign.
And brilliant. And it's one of those things that you look and you listen to, you think, I cannot believe that it didn't exist before, you know, and brilliant, because it is people like you that enable that kind of change to happen when, you know, on paper it's so ridiculous that it wasn't there before. So, you know, that's really brilliant. But I think it's also extraordinary that the two of you have been together for so long, because, you know, we know that one in two marriages don't last. Our industry is notorious for relationships and marriages to not last, and partnerships to not. Martin's also in the industry, runs a great PR company. How have you made it work?
Well, I think actually work has been quite a glue in our relationship, in that it's always given us common ground. So we share many interests, like country walks and the same TV shows and things like that. But because we don't work together or in exactly the same part of the industry, we haven't had any kind of work-related tensions, but we've always had a lot of work stories and people in common, and that's really helped. Of course, we've had arguments in the kitchen in the morning about who's going to be back in time to look after the children and all of that sort of stuff. But I genuinely think one of the reasons that we've had such a good relationship over such a long time is that we have both really enjoyed our careers. So I've been out of the home a lot, probably more than I would have wished when my kids were little. But it has meant that I've always had an energy and an enthusiasm and a kind of positivity that comes from enjoying my job. And Martin the same. So that had my career not been as fulfilling and busy, it might have put more pressure on my relationship, ironically. But that joy that's come from work has influenced how we come home at the end of the day, you know, very much that tired but happy kind of approach. So yeah, there's no secret to it. We've both got very busy lives outside of our relationship, which is another thing that helps. I think we don't spend that much time together.
Well, but you know, but that's great, isn't it? And that's it's a great insight, isn't it? If you have a sense of purpose and you really love your job, it enables you, you know, we know it's very good for our general kind of well-being and the performance that we have, but it can impact the rest of our lives. And you've clearly done that. And I guess that leads me on to the last sort of big reset that I wanted to talk about. You know, you talked a little bit before around the number of cuts that were made at Campaign magazine and across Haymarket, like a lot of media groups, and you were then made redundant. I mean, how did that feel, having been there for so long?
Yeah. When I was called into consultation and I had that first conversation about, because I kind of felt as soon as I knew I was in consultation, that's it. You know, I don't know many people for whom consultation ends up being a positive in terms of their job with that company. But that initial conversation, I was definitely kind of a bit wobbly on, because it's never very nice to be told we don't want you anymore. But as soon as that conversation was over, and it was maybe only a 10 or 15 minute conversation, I must admit, I had loved my job so much that I could never have imagined leaving. And that used to worry me. It's like, how am I ever gonna not be here until I retire? And they wouldn't have bothered me to be there until I retired, but it kind of meant that I knew how my life was going to pan out for the next 10 years. So as soon as that conversation was over, the door to the gilded cage, which I was kind of in a way, opened, and immediately, and maybe this is an adrenaline thing that kicks in, I don't know, but immediately I felt excited, full of possibilities and opportunities, a little bit like, sod it, I'm going to roll my sleeves up and show them this is a stupid mistake.
Yeah,
because I'm going to go and do something really amazing.
Yeah,
and they're going to miss me. Ooh. So I was immediately
driver,
just like really bouncing. And it actually really helped that it all coincided with us coming out of the first lockdown. So I came out of that meeting almost immediately when the world was started to open up. I spent weeks charging around London, meeting up with lots of people, having lots of exciting conversations. It was a massive surge of energy and positivity. And I know that for many, many, many people, that is not their experience. But I don't know, I just embraced it as an opportunity to change the narrative on my life. And what now? I didn't know how the next 10 years of my life were going to pan out. That was exciting.
Yes, yes. But you have started a business yourself with some other people. Talk to us about the Creative Salon. Why did you create it and what's it going to do?
Okay, so I did get some really juicy, interesting conversations came my way when I left Campaign.
Sure.
And I did think, here's my moment to earn a lot more money, because you don't get paid very much money. Yeah. Actually, that was probably helped in a way. I wasn't sacrificing a massive salary because I never had one. So I wasn't, being made redundant wasn't such a financial shockwave as it might be had I been earning a lot more. I thought maybe this is the moment when I'm going to go and get a big, what I thought of in my head as a proper job, corporate job, and I'm going to earn more money. And I mm-hmm. certainly had those conversations. But delightfully, as soon as it became known widely that I was leaving, I had such a tidal wave of support, so many emails and phone calls and texts from people saying really supportive, lovely, amazing things. And to your point about who's going to be at your funeral, well, maybe all of those people were doing it because they thought I might land somewhere that I was going to be useful to them in the future. I don't know. But I was completely overwhelmed by how supportive and generous and lovely so many people were. It was seriously overwhelming.
And by the way, I think that is genuine. I really do think. I think we don't want to even keep talking about funerals. It's a silly thing to remove to bring up. But, you know, I do think that those moments do allow people to say how much they value you and to give you a moment to say you've done a lot for the industry and you did do a lot for the industry. So,
But it really made me feel I don't want to then go and work for one company where 99.9% of the people that I love and have loved spending time with don't need to talk to me anymore. So what can I do that means that I still have license to spend time with these amazing people? So pretty quickly I thought, well, obviously I've loved being a journalist. I love having that platform, that little bit of influence. But more than all of that, I love having that access to these amazing creative minds. So I started talking to the woman that's now my business partner, Sunu Singh, who had worked in the industry for almost as long as I had. We never knew each other very well. We were kind of circled each other a lot and were competitive. She'd worked with me for a little bit on Campaign doing some maternity leave cover for one of my colleagues, but we had not really spent very much time together at all. But whenever we did, it was always obvious that we loved the same things about the industry, enjoyed the same people's company, had lots of common contacts, but were also really complementary in that there was part of the industry that I knew better than she did, and vice versa. We both felt, to be blunt about it, that we'd spent most of our careers working for companies who happened to make money out of the industry that we loved,
yes,
but didn't love the industry that we loved. So I was coming from a company that made money out of all sorts of different industries, from wind power to the medical industry, and it just happened to have a brand that served the advertising industry. But the people running Haymarket didn't have the depth of emotional connection or contacts with the advertising industry. It was a business for them, yeah. And yeah. The same for Sanu. So we wanted to create a business that was born out of, I'm my toes used to curl when I said this, but I've kind of got used to saying it and I'm embracing it now. We wanted to create a business that was born out of our love for the industry and our love for the people in it, that existed to support the industry, not just make money out of it. Yes. So we didn't want to be a pariah. We wanted to be a force for good. And we wanted to be a force for good for the people and the companies that we know and love. And we wanted to be a force for good for the people coming up behind them. So we tried to work out a business model that would allow us to champion brilliant work being done by brilliant people, to be a powerful advocate for the power of commercial creativity to drive business growth and to drive the economy, and to leverage our network and our influence to ensure that a really secure future for the industry by supporting a new cohort of diverse talent to come in. So one of the principles of our business is that we donate at least 10% of our profits every year to organizations that are helping nurture diverse new talent. And one, our first partner is the Brixton Finishing School. So we're working with them, and they'll be the recipient of any extra monies that we make over certainly the first year. But I think, I'm not sure how much money we're going to make in our first year, probably enough. Well, some packets of biscuits and jars of coffee. But anyway, that was really important to us, to create a business finally that existed to support and nurture, celebrate and secure the future of the industry.
Brilliant. Well, what a fabulous thing to do. And I think, you know, you and Sanu are a brilliant team. You've got some fantastic journalists and writers that are with you and supporting you. And I think, you know, what I've heard today has been lovely, because so often, as you said, what we see from you, Claire, is this amazing journalist, somebody who's been in the industry for the whole time, but actually you've got such a lot of depth of thinking and of experience. I think it's brilliant to hear you talk about wanting to create your own thing, where you have the passion, you can make the difference, and you make it within an environment that genuinely cares about the industry and the people. And I think, like me, I feel very privileged to have been in the marketing and communications industry for a lot of my working life. And I think we're very lucky that we've loved our jobs, but I think we're even luckier when we create businesses that have a purpose to them. And certainly I wish you and Sanu every success in the future. And, you know, as I said just a few moments ago, it is great sometimes that you get to a moment in your career where the outpouring of love, affection and respect can come to you at a time when you don't die. And you did that moment when you left Campaign. And I know for a fact, because I talked to so many people about you, that was a moment for all of us to reach out and to say thank you for everything that you've done, to share some of the mistakes that you've made, but also to just acknowledge the amount that you've done for the industry. And so I want to say thank you. Thank you for sharing some of your resets today. And I look forward to seeing how your business grows in the next year.
Thank you so much, Suki. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson, with me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny.
Music provided by Audio Network.